There's a lot of information out there if you have time to go look at it. We didn't really have time in this class. There's a lot of information out there as far as archaeology is concerned that really really shows that the Bible is couched in historical truth. And a couple things I want to say about archaeology. We shouldn't expect too much of the discipline. We shouldn't expect it to, you know, prove the Bible in the sense that we shouldn't expect to dig up, you know, bones of everybody that lived in the Bible. You know, obviously there's things that aren't going to exist, but there's a lot of evidence out there that shows that the things that are said in the Bible, that there were actual people that and that historical events that it fits right along with. For instance, in the Old Testament, Hezekiah, there's an inscription found of a tunnel that he dug, and many of the people that many of the kings of the Old Testament that attacked Jerusalem and that are found in the Bible, like Sargon and Sennacherib, they actually lived, and there's actual evidence of them. In the New Testament, there are many examples of things that were actually true that could fit right along in with what the Bible gives as accurate history. I was reading something today just about Sergius Paulus and how you know, there's factual finds in archaeology about that. And so all those things line up exactly with the Bible as far as the Bible being accurate history, that it certainly is couched in true history. And so there's a lot that we could spend time, we could spend a whole class period on archaeology, but you know, it's not really given in our text, and so I'm going to go ahead and move on past that. But if you ever have time, look at, we have plenty of books in the library about archaeology that you can look at that really show how the Bible is actual history. As far as scientific foreknowledge is concerned, most of us have heard about this topic before, but if we haven't, basically the idea is if the Bible is God's Word, it's going to speak accurately on scientific truths well before we may even discover them as men. And so we would expect ancient writers, if they're writing by God's inspired Word, to write in a way that would be scientifically accurate. And if it touches on truths that are accurate scientifically that we haven't discovered for hundreds or thousands of years, then that certainly would show that they weren't just writing from their own education or their own thought, but that God was actually behind them. Because whatever we do in the field of the sciences, we're kind of just thinking God's thoughts after him or discovering what he has had there all along the way, right? And but at the same time, if the Bible has a bunch of errors in it that people that of ancient times would you know, make mistakes along the same lines, then that would be a testimony to the fact that it wasn't inspired of God. And so as we look into this, there's a lot in the Bible that we can look at as far as scientific foreknowledge that would point to the fact that God was behind what's said in the Bible. Moses is said to be trained in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians. Acts 7, verse 22, Stephen said that. And many people think that the laws that Moses writes in the Pentateuch, in the first five books of the New Testament, there's some people that suggest that, well, he just did this because he was educated in the ways of the Egyptians. Well, the first major section that I want to look at that you have on your outline here is medicine, the field of medicine. And if you look in the Pentateuch at what Moses has to say about medicine, you know, being inspired of God, it is far superior to what the Egyptians had as far as their medical practices. And by the world standards, the Egyptians were renowned for being very advanced in the field of medicine. Now, I hope you all have strong stomachs here tonight. You know, we're going to be talking about some things that are, you know, I'm used to it because my wife's a nurse, so she tells me stories all the time. So if anybody has a weak stomach, you know, I'm warning you now. There's things we're going to talk about in detail that you know, aren't the most pleasant topics, but have to do with the field of medicine. And we can look, compare what the Bible says with what the ancient Egyptians had as far as their prescriptions and remedies for medical problems. And we can see that there's a huge difference. And so we know that Moses didn't use his learning when he wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. He certainly was being directed by God. Now let's look at a few of these Egyptian prescriptions for problems. The Egyptians, as I said, were renowned in the ancient world for their progress in medicine. And sadly, though, many of their remedies that they had for things actually caused more harm than they did good. Well-meaning doctors many times would inflict more pain and cause the death of people if you went to see them instead of helping them out. Here's some examples. As far as getting a splinter, if you have a splinter in your hand and you can't get it out, the remedy of this, they would apply something that consisted of worm blood and mole and donkey dung to the wound. Okay, now, you look, dung is loaded with tetanus spores, and so somebody that had something as simple as a splinter many times would die because of lockjaw, because they went to see the doctor and the doctor would infect them because the remedy that they had for it included this dung that had all this tetanus spores in it. And in your book you have a lot more examples of this, but several of the remedies included excrement, and they were applied to the wound. And today we obviously, you know about the germs and the things that would go along with that wouldn't make that good at all. In fact, in God's treatment of excrement in the Bible is completely different from the Egyptians. If you go over to Deuteronomy 23 and verse 13, the Bible even says that when they were out there in the wilderness, they were supposed to have a paddle on their spear, and they were supposed to dig in the earth and cover up their excrement so that no unclean thing would come before the Lord. Well, certainly there was sanitary laws to this. It says, "And thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, and it shall be when thou ease thyself abroad that thou shalt dig therewith, and shall turn back and cover that which cometh from thee. For the Lord thy God walketh in the midst of thy camp to deliver thee, and to give up thine enemies before thee. Therefore shall thy camp be holy, and that he see no unclean thing in thee, and turn away from thee." And so the way that the Jews dealt with human waste saved them a lot of hardship and a lot of sickness that some other people were using as medicine and actually exposing people to it. Now, now as I said before, the Egyptians were very advanced. So if you can show that the Jews were advanced beyond the Egyptians, then you're showing that they're advanced beyond all cultures of this time. And so, how else are we going to explain this, other than the fact that God was behind this and he knew all of these things and he knew what man could handle and what germs were there? God created everything. He knew all of this. And there's a book that's entitled None of These Diseases. It's supposed to be in our library. I was going to use it as a reference for this this lesson. I could not find it. Somebody's taken it. So maybe it'll show up there sometime. Nobody's checked it out, so I don't know. But none of these diseases, and it's referring to what the Bible for none of these diseases will come upon you. When the Jews were very healthy compared to the other nations of the time, because God was giving them these parameters to go by. The Egyptians thought that pus was good. If a wound was issuing forth pus, they thought that was part of the healing process. And sometimes well-meaning doctors would deliberately infect the wound so that it would produce pus, and they thought that that would heal it. And in fact, they were just infecting people's wounds and making things worse. Another thing along the line of this, in looking at the Pentateuch, the first idea for people to use anesthesia actually came from the Bible. People went to Genesis 2:21, And they read that God had put a deep sleep upon Adam, and he slept, and he took the rib, and from the rib made a woman. And so people started experimenting with the idea of putting somebody under some sort of chemical or taking something to make them sleep, so that they didn't just have to bite a towel or something as they went through surgery. And so the Bible actually has given man, helped man along in the whole process of medicine, not only showing truths before we ever discovered them on our own, but has actually helped us in discovering the truths. As far as blood is concerned, bloodletting was a common medical practice for over 2,000 years. And people thought that there were certain vapors or certain things in the blood that caused somebody to be sick. And so because of that, if you let some of it out, then they figured that you would be doing better. In fact, our first president, George Washington, the way he died, he developed a throat infection, and 1.7 liters of blood were withdrawn from his body shortly before he died. Now, he probably would have lived longer if he, wasn't going to the doctors and having them take the blood from him. And yet the Bible declared all along the way in Leviticus 17 and verse 11, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. That's why they weren't supposed to eat the blood, right? And today, we don't know all the things that blood does, really. I mean, but, we have blood drives, people donate blood, people sell blood, give blood, package blood. It's very, very important in the medical process today. We know that it, carries oxygen to every part of the body, that it's very essential. And truly it can be said that the life of the flesh is in the blood, just as God said thousands of years ago. And yet, even up till the 19th century, we were still commonly practicing bloodletting, and people were dying from it. And another thing along the line of blood that I thought about, now, this is sort of an incidental thing, but I think that it has some weight to it. Acts 17 and verse 26, Paul said that God has made of one blood all nations to dwell on the face of the earth, all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth. And it's interesting, as we've tested blood, there's no difference in the race, which race has which blood. Some people have been killed in times past because it said, you got a blood transfusion from this race, you mixed the blood. But human blood is human blood. Now there's different, types based on the antigens in it, right? But as far as saying, this is blood from an Asian, or this is blood from a Caucasian, or, you can't judge it. Now there is a difference between human blood and animal blood, though. And speaking of the background that we talked about as far as evolution, you look at early evolutionary models, and they would line the skull of the gorilla up, and next to it they put the black man, then the Asian man, and then the Caucasian. And they would say, see, here's the transition. And they would say the black man is closer to the gorilla, and as he developed more mentally, he became the Caucasian. So you see why there are certain, things that people used in genocide, like Hitler, forming the Aryan race. But if that was going to make sense, wouldn't you have the blood of a black person to be more closely related to that of a monkey? And yet you can tell there's a difference between monkey blood, a big difference between the blood of a monkey and the blood of humans. And there's no difference in the races, as far as we can tell. And the Bible said this thousands of years ago. He's made one of one blood, all nations. As far as germs are concerned, in your text, the story is told of this man whose last name is Semmelweis, I believe. Now, I'm going to be pronouncing a lot of things tonight that I'm not really sure about, but in 1847, he was a director of a hospital ward in Vienna, Austria. And the interesting thing was, about 18% of the women, he was an obstetrician, about 18% of the women that came into the ward never came out. In fact, one in six of them died of labor fever. And whenever they delivered at home by a midwife, the percentage was only 1%. But when they were coming into the ward and using the best medicine of the time, 1 in 6 of them were dying. So this is very, you know, disconcerting. And they're trying all different things. They're trying to figure out what's going wrong. And lo and behold, what they were doing was is that they were performing autopsies. The doctors would perform autopsies on the dead mothers. And then immediately after that, without washing whatsoever, they would go and do examinations and internal examinations on the living mothers. Now, today we would say, what doctor would do that? And in fact, if they did wash, all they would do is put their hands in some bloody water and use a common towel, and then they'd go over to the next. The only reason that they would think somebody would clean up is just for looks. Because they didn't understand, here in 1847, they didn't understand that there were germs, and that they were spreading different germs and diseases because they had just touched the dead body, and now they're touching living mothers. And so they started washing their hands thoroughly in a chlorine solution, and lo and behold, the number dropped down to 1% of the women coming into their care dying. And so you might have thought, well, Simovice has discovered something. But the Bible declared way back in Numbers 19 and verse 11, he that touches a dead body of any man shall be unclean 7 days. And there were things that somebody had to go through if they were unclean, to become clean. They had to wash all of their selves, all of their clothes, shave their head. There was a bunch of different directions that you find in the Bible that somebody had to go through in order to become clean again. And that would have taken care of it if people had followed the Jewish laws of Numbers 19. So God was taking care of his people all the way back then with the medical practices of sanitation. As far as water purification, we turn over to Numbers 19 and there's different ingredients that are given for the water purification that somebody would use to cleanse themselves if they were pronounced unclean. And at first, we might look at some of these things in the Old Testament, we might just think that there's some ceremonial thing, and that they wouldn't have any practical medical value. But look at the ingredients we have here. We have ashes of a red heifer, hyssop, cedar wood, and scarlet. Now, you might think that this is just some ceremonial thing, or some hodgepodge of different things that God has arbitrarily chosen. But if you look a little more closely at these ingredients, many people used to make lye soap, right? And in fact, lye in high concentrations is actually caustic to the skin. That's pretty much what you would find in certain drain cleaners, high concentration of lye. But in low concentration, it's good for cleansing. It's good soap. Well, often a way that you can make lye is to pour water through ashes. The ashes of a red heifer would work. And so, in that sense, you're making soap, or at least a cleaning agent. Hyssop contains antiseptic thymol, a mold that produces penicillin, grows on leaves of hyssop. Hyssop can also be used as an expectorant for bronchitis and phlegm. And so, there's medical uses for that. Cedar wood, many times people make cabinets out of cedar, because it repels insects, it won't decay, right? Well, if you have cedar in the oil form, it can be used as an antiseptic, astringent, expectorant, antifungal, sedative, and insecticide. Cedar leaves are rich in vitamin C. Extracts of cedar have been used by some German researchers to inhibit the reproduction of influenza virus type A. And some researchers in Japan have used an extract of western red cedar, and they said that it has been shown to be effective in treating eczema. So very interesting what these different ingredients in water purification would show. In fact, I meant to bring it with me. It's something this reminded me of is when I went into college, the first year that I went to Tennessee Tech University, there were a lot of classes there, and there were a lot of teachers there that didn't believe in God. So there's, you know, there were challenging things that you had to deal with. But something that I thought was very interesting is in my college chemistry book, there was, we were studying the chemistry there, and there was a section down at the Bible, down at the bottom, that said chemistry in the Bible. And it talked about when Moses had taken the sun bleached wood and put it into the water when the water was bitter. And it actually said that something to do with the amino acids, that could actually cause water to be purified by, you know, putting that sun bleached bark and running water through it. And now this was a textbook that was used at a state university, all right? And yet in the bottom of it, they're saying, well, Moses didn't need to know the technology in order to use it. And they were recognizing the fact that, you know, God knew these things. Now, I don't know, what that might have been a miracle, or God might have used, you know, just scientific foreknowledge to make it take place. But I just thought it was amazing that they were admitting that enough to put it into the college textbooks, which many times would teach against God. And then, I don't know if this would help at all, but they were supposed to put scarlet in it, and if you are going to put scarlet wool in there, scarlet wool fibers could actually help with scrubbing. You know, people used to use lava soap, you know, that had the little parts of volcanic pumice or whatever in it. Yeah, that would help scrub off the grease of the end, you know, or whatever that you had on your hands. Well, scarlet wool fibers would, you know, perform a similar action. And so you look at all the ingredients that you have here in Numbers 19, and it really seems to be a good way to clean somebody, you know, as far as what they had, and purifying themselves. As far as the clean and unclean things that the Bible has to talk about, you look over in the book of Leviticus, especially Leviticus chapter 11, and the Bible has a lot to say about the Jews and clean and unclean meats. Now, we don't have these laws today. Paul writes to Timothy that every creature of God is acceptable, you know, sanctified by the word of God and prayer. So those that would forbid meats today are not, you know, not teaching the truth. So we're allowed to eat, you know, all different kinds of meats today. But in Leviticus chapter 11, we all know some very famous ones, like they weren't supposed to eat pork, right? They were only supposed to eat of beasts that part the hoof and chew the cud, you know, all that's taken out there. But in 1953, a doctor named David Macht, I believe, would be, he was studying the difference between blood of healthy humans and blood of cancerous humans. And part of the study, what he was doing was putting, he would put seedlings into different muscle juices of different animals and see the toxicity level of these different animals. And he did studies before that, but he did a more extensive study in 1953, and his results are interesting. As far as this muscle juice toxicity is concerned, the unclean animals had much higher toxicity than the clean animals did. The clean animals, the seedlings were relatively ineffective. They were very high percentage. But animals such as, you know, a horse or a pig that, you know, that weren't clean, they had much higher toxicity in their system. And, you know, you can go through your book and look a little bit more at that. And also another good reference along this line is Behold the Word of God by Kyle Butt. That's a little more expanded edition of what you have in your textbook. The blowfish was a unclean animal, according to the Old Testament. You know, of course, they were only allowed to eat things that had scales, according to the Levitical laws there, clean and unclean. But we know that today the blowfish has very strong toxins in certain parts of it, in I guess the ovaries and other parts of the blowfish. And so very few people in the world eat it. It is a delicacy in Japan, but it has to be prepared by certified chefs that know what they're doing, that know which parts can be need to be taken part taken out. But even at that, sometimes there can be a mistake. And that's why the Emperor of Japan, you're not allowed to give him blowfish, because that toxin called tetrodotoxin is very strong, several times stronger than cocaine or anything else. It will kill somebody. But that the Japanese use it as a delicacy, I guess pronounced fugu. But I thought it was pretty interesting. But instead of dealing with preparing that the right way, God made that in the realm of something unclean. As far as shellfish, the FDA has released a lot of things concerning undercooked oysters and how they can really cause a lot of problems and even cause death. The Bible, not only talking about things that dwell on the earth, not only would rule out reptiles by the very definition, since they don't part the hoof or chew the cud, but it mentions them in particular. Leviticus chapter 11 verse 30 talks about the chameleon and the lizard. And an interesting thing about reptiles is that they are 90% of them are carriers of salmonella. Now, you know, several animals, I suppose almost any animal could carry salmonella, even maybe our own pets could. But lizards and other types of reptiles are much more frequent in carrying salmonella, and you don't even have to touch them if you touch something that they've touched, or, you know, part of their anything that they've touched, or something their excrement has touched. If you touch any of that, it can be passed. So instead of dealing with all of that, God has ruled out the reptiles. Bats, you know, very, very frequent for bats to have rabies. Of course, other animals can, but, you know, bats especially. In fact, it's advised if, you know, somebody's even around or had dealings with bats, that they get checked for that and make sure. And so Leviticus 11:19 would rule them out. And then, of course, we know pork. Very famous one. They didn't eat pork, but of course we know that hogs are, or pigs are, scavengers, right? They eat a bunch of, you know, things that cause more parasites and bacteria to be in their muscle tissue, and that's fine if you cook it well. If you cook it well, all of that will be taken care of. But if it's undercooked, if you eat raw pork, there's parasites and bacteria in there, even tapeworm. There's also something that can cause toxoplasmosis, which is a disease affecting the nervous system. And so God rules out all of these unclean animals, not just arbitrarily, but because they had to be prepared a certain way if somebody was going to stay healthy. So you see, all along this line, God is showing medical things that we didn't discover till thousands of years later. The male circumcision, as far as the health benefits of it, of course we know that all of the Jews were required to be circumcised. Genesis 17, verse 11, God gave that command to Abraham, and then it's repeated in the law. But as far as the health benefits of it, you know, reduces the incidence of urinary tract infections in males. Sexually transmitted diseases are passed more readily among the uncircumcised, and virtually eliminates the chances of penile cancer. And as far as the day on which he commanded it to be done, on the eighth day, the Bible commands that on the eighth day, Leviticus 12:3, they'll be circumcised. As far as bleeding out and having uncontrollable bleeding, especially in the young infants, that's controlled by this thing called prothrombin, which is related to how much vitamin K is somebody has. So the more vitamin K somebody has, the more prothrombin somebody will have, and the better the clotting factor is. Well, 90%, when somebody is born, a child is born, they're about 90% of normal levels of prothrombin that they'll have throughout the rest of their life. That drops right after that. On the third day, it's only 35%. But then it climbs until it peaks at 110% on the eighth day. And so on the eighth day, you have 20% more prothrombin than you would on the first day, and 10% more than you'll ever have in the rest of your life. And so if you're going to select the ideal day to perform circumcision, it would certainly be on the eighth day. Now, how did Moses know about that, to command the eighth day? They just do a bunch of tests with babies and say, well, he's bleeding out. You know, that. It certainly was God behind it. And today we don't usually circumcise people on the eighth day. I guess we do it because they don't stay in the hospital that long. You know, we do it the first or second day when the prothrombin is still pretty high. But under those ancient times and, you know, the crude means in which they were going about it, compared to what the precision that we have today, certainly the eighth day would be ideal. And so all of this showing God's wisdom and being behind it. Now, some other things besides medicine. There's some things that the Bible mentions. You've probably heard of all of these things before. The fact that the stars are innumerable. Genesis 22, 17, Jeremiah 33, 22. The stars cannot be numbered, the Bible plainly declares. And over time, over the centuries, man has tried to count the stars, and the count has gone from hundreds to thousands to millions as we've gotten telescopes that we can see further and further into space. And now we basically concluded that there's too many to count, because every single time we probe deeper into space, we find more and more galaxies even. But the Bible all along the way has said, Jeremiah 33, verse 22, the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured. So I will multiply the seed of David, my servant, and the Levites that minister unto me. So the Bible plainly declared that they were innumerable. At one point, before we had the telescopes, we thought, well, we've basically counted them all. And then we realized that there were more out there that we couldn't see with the naked eye. And so, another example. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians 15:41, in talking there about the resurrection, uses the example of one star differing from another star in glory. Now, you've all seen pictures of stars. Some of them are different colors. You know, people say this star is this age and this age. You know, of course, they have these billions of years on it. And they don't account for the fact that God could have made things very mature in their time, just like making a mature earth, you know. Just like he made Adam mature, right? Didn't make Adam a baby. But anyway, we have different stars that have different colors and, you know, different glories of each other. And, you know, with the naked eye, stars usually basically look just like stars, right? So we've had these high-powered telescopes. We haven't been able to tell that one star differs from another star in glory. And yet, 1 Corinthians 15:41 declares that succinctly. How did Paul know that? Did he have a telescope? Maybe he went to the Hubble telescope and looked up there. Obviously, he was inspired by God. As far as astronomy is concerned, though, there are some people that would point out, well, the Bible does use unscientific terms when it talks about the sun. For instance, you go over to Psalm 16 and verse 6. Psalm 16, verse 6. Here the Bible talking about, you know, I think 19, verse 6, sorry. The Bible talking about the heavens declaring the glory of God, the firmament showing His handiwork, a verse that we went to, talking about how we know that God created the world. But in talking about the sun, it says His going forth is from one end of heaven to another. And they say, well, don't you realize that we're revolving around the sun? And so the sun is not going from one end of heaven to the other. Or Jesus said in Matthew 5:45 that God causes His sun to rise on the just and on the unjust. So He uses the term rise, right? Well, it's been hundreds of years since we figured out that the earth revolves around the sun. Of course, we know we have Copernicus and Galileo that did work along that line, and they were you know, both got in trouble with the Catholic Church for discovering those things. But do we still use sunrise, sunset?
Mm-hmm.
If I say, did you see the sunrise this morning, or did you see the sunset last night? Somebody doesn't say, oh, come on, you know, we revolve around the sun, it doesn't revolve around us. Are we using that in an accommodative sense, in the sense of how it relates to us in our life? Yes. And so, is the Bible allowed to use things in an accommodative sense? Certainly. And so, people will put certain expectations on the Bible that they wouldn't put on anything else. And that's one of the problems that they have with it. But that doesn't prove that the Bible is saying something that's non-scientific. Again, you know, the Bible is not a science book. It's not a medical book. But when it speaks on these things, it speaks truth. It speaks accurately. As far as geophysics, the earth is round. You've heard these verses before. Sits on the circle of the earth, Isaiah 40:22. He set a compass upon the face of the earth. The word compass there meaning the, you know, a circle in nature, the horizon being a circle. And you know, if Christopher Columbus had read this, he might have had a, you know, a little better idea about where he was going and where he had wound up, or anybody during those days. Of course, the idea of it being held in place by gravity, a couple hundred years ago, you could probably have had an educated scientific discussion on what held the earth up. What is it sitting on? And yet the Bible says in Job 26, verse 7, he stretches the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing. So, again, the Bible is obviously way ahead of man in figuring these things out. Hydrology and oceanography, the water cycle, you know, we've obviously witnessed, you know, the rain and everything, but the idea of how did it get back up to wherever it comes from? Why does it keep going? Evaporation and condensation, you know, we've only really started to understand the water cycle in the last few centuries. And yet the Bible in Ecclesiastes 1, verses 6 and 7 says that there's no end to these things. You know, the waters return from whence they came. You know, they're evaporated and they return from whence they came. Job 36, beginning at verse 27, they're talking about, you know, the vapor in heaven and things along that line. And so the water cycles spoken of in a true way in the Bible. The story is told as far as the path of the sea that we hear read, we hear talked about in Psalm 8 and verse 8, that Matthew Fontaine Maury was sick, and his son, he had his son reading the Bible to him, and he read Psalm 8, and it mentions the path of the sea in verse 8. And Matthew Fontaine Maury said, well, if I get better, I'm going to find out what these paths of the sea are. And then the sea currents, I mean, he helped discover them because of what the Bible said. Now, I don't, you know, people dispute the historicity of that, I guess, in some ways, but that's just like the thing over in Genesis 2 about using some sort of anesthetic to put somebody to sleep in surgery. And then Job 38, verse 16, talks about the springs of the sea and, you know, people getting down to the bottom of the sea. Certainly hasn't been something that we've done throughout our existence. You know, only with technology when we've been able to supply oxygen to ourselves or go take cameras down there. And yet the Bible can speak about what's at the bottom of the sea, that there are springs there. And that's because it's God doing the talking, because it's God's creation. And so over and over again we have in the Bible example after example of God speaking truthfully on things that relate to science and medicine. And this is so far ahead of anything that we have been doing on our own, or thinking on our own, that the only explanation for it is that it is a divine book. Does anybody have any questions or comments they'd like to make on this? Anybody? Okay, there's no required reading for today, for this week. Next week, we're going to cover alleged contradictions in the Bible. And there's certainly plenty that people have considered over the years, so hope you'll join us for that study. Nobody has anything else, I'll let you all go.